Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. WNYC, and 50 years ago this month, the Black Panther Party was born in Oakland, California, originally called the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. It became known both for arming people as a way to deter police brutality and for widespread social welfare programs aimed at helping people survive poverty and creating the conditions for revolutionary political change. One of the co-founders was Bobby Seale, born 80 years ago this month. Bobby Seale joins us now, along with the Panthers' longtime photographer, Stephen Shames. You say Shames or Shames?
Shames.
Today, and together, they have a new book of words and images called Power to the People, The World of the Black Panthers. We posted a couple of images on our webpage if you want to see what some of the images from the book look like at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Thanks very much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
We have a lot of younger listeners who don't know that much about the Black Panthers and don't know that much about you. So, Bobby Seale, let me start here. The book says, the assassination of Malcolm X here in New York in February 1965 was a turning point in your life. Can you recall how the killing of Malcolm X affected you and influenced the founding of the Black Panther Party?
Well, it was a turning point that I dedicated myself to what I call my Black liberation struggle. I dedicated myself. But the real point of me causing me to get into the protest movement struggle was really Dr. Martin Luther King 2 years before that, 3 years before that, in fact. It was Martin Luther King who I went to hear speak at the Oakland Auditorium holding 7,000 people. And it was Dr. King who was talking about how we have to organize and get Black people jobs in this country and go up against institutionalized racism, and how many companies will not hire Black folks. And I remember Dr. King very, very clearly at one point in his speech, and he was speaking about the San Francisco Oakland Bay Area where we were. He says, and here in the San Francisco Oakland Bay Area, Langendorf Bread Company and Kilpatrick's Bread Company would not hire any people of color. He says, and all across America, I say Wonder Bread Company will not hire any people of color. I say we're going to have to boycott them, and we want to boycott them so consistently and so profoundly. We want to make Wonder Bread wonder where the money went. And that just broke that audience. And then 7,000 people, and I'm just one individual, hit the floor in applause. I was totally inspired by this man.
And you do a good Martin Luther King.
Yeah, well, I'm a stand-up comedian and other things and jazz drum and all that other kind of stuff. But,
and Stephen, you recall a turning point in your life when you got your first camera here in New York in the so-called Summer of Love in 1967 when you were a college student on summer break from UC Berkeley. Did you think from the start that you would use the camera to document social change or activists like the Black Panthers?
In the beginning, no. But when I went back to Berkeley, the Berkeley campus at that time was kind of the center. Berkeley was like the epicenter of the revolution in the 60s. And there was police action on the campus. All kinds of things were going on. And very early, I met Bobby, and he became a mentor to me and kind of brought me into the party. And I guess they liked my pictures, and I loved them. And so I just very soon kept going.
And Bobby, the original name was the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, but it became known as the Black Panthers. Did self-defense get officially dropped after a while?
It took about a year and a half. Too many people kept confusing us as a paramilitary group, and we were a political group. We were a political organization with a full 10-point program that dealt with employment issues, decent housing, preventative medical health care, end to police brutality, fair treatment in the courts, etc.
Which is reprinted in the book, by the way.
I'll mention
the What We Want Now 10-point list.
It's often reprinted, but the most important part of that point program in writing that, I saw to it that I used the first two paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence, a paraphrasing of the Declaration of Independence, United States of America, to summarize that 10-point platform and program. So that's what's most important, to get the summary of what our action was and how we were political.
Rather than paramilitary. But I'd like to play a recording of you from a moment in 1967 that Stephen writes about near the beginning of the book, and you come to later, and ask you to reflect on it now. This is you at a protest against a gun control bill in the California state legislature that Ronald Reagan, as governor of California, was in favor of.
Ronald Reagan is over here on the big front lawn. I got a statement to read.
The Black Panther Party for Self-Defense calls upon the American people in general, and the black people in particular, to take careful note of the racist California legislature, which is now considering legislation aimed at keeping the black people disarmed and powerless at the very same time racist police agencies throughout the country are intensifying the terror, brutality, murder, and repression of black people.
You do a good Bobby Seale as well as a good Martin Luther King. But we also played that clip earlier this week as part of a history of the gun rights versus gun control movements. Do you recall the circumstances?
I recall all the circumstances. In fact, Ronald Reagan was out on the front lawn talking to a group of 100 or so youth, 10, 12, and 15 years old or something like that. And as we walked up the big broad walk, the kids left Ronald Reagan to come over to see us. They thought we were a neat gun club, you know what I mean? And they knew the kind of weapons we had, neat 30-06, et cetera, and so on. In effect, I wanted to go inside after I read my statement to the press, and then I wanted to go to the spectator section, which you can view the assembly in the process of making law. And this horde of press, 50, 60 press people, leading me down the hall. It was a big crowd, et cetera. Several people got ahead of me and my crew. They went into the actual chambers. I'm looking for the spectator section. And when I get there, we're in the wrong place. And the president then the cameras rush in following these five party members in front of me, with their shotguns just resting on their shoulders, you know what I mean? And the president pro tempore is banging the gavel that the press is not allowed on the floor while the assembly's in session. Bam, bam, bam. He's granted. Actually, he's not even noticing the guns on the guy's shoulders. And I run in, and I'm trying to say, hey, you guys, come on, man, get out of here. We're in the wrong place. This is not the spectator section, damn it. Come on, come on. And other guys is ducking under the seat. Some of the state assemblymen are ducking under. I'm saying, hey, you guys, I'm sorry. These guys led me in the wrong place. Come on, you guys, we're in the wrong place. Really, that's really what happened. And I say that because immediately after that, in the press, Ronald Reagan is calling us hoodlums and thugs, invading the Capitol, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I went there to read a simple statement about a piece of legislation that was going to try to stop. We'd been patrolling police for 6 months, observing police, and that's how legal we were. See, when the police, when we first went out there, I remember that January night we went out there, the cop says, you have no right to observe us. I says, no, California State Supreme Court ruling states that every citizen has a right to stand and observe a police officer carrying out their duty as long as they stand a reasonable distance away. A reasonable distance in that particular ruling was constituted as 8 to 10 feet. We're standing approximately 20 feet from you, and we observe it whether you like it or not. Now, we're citing the law to the cop. We have guns. We're not pointing guns. Why? Because there's a law against pointing loaded guns at anyone, even if you have no intention of shooting and just waving around, you point a loaded gun at the person. Under California law, it constituted assault with a deadly weapon. We knew every law in conjunction with our civil rights and the whole. And this is what
blew. But that law was intended to stop you from even displaying the weapons?
No. What they did is they made a law, Mulford, that said you cannot carry a loaded weapon inside city limits within 150 feet of public property and public property included all roadways and byways. So you would have to be 150 feet from the public sidewalk before you could load your weapon. And then what this constitutes a loaded weapon? A loaded weapon. See, every law we know, a loaded weapon is a live round in the chamber, not the magazine, etc.
But so that was aimed at the Panther
Patrol. It was
aimed
specifically at us because we were patrolling the police for 6 months quite legally all around the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Area. And in effect, they made this law. What we did is we went on the radio and went on television and said, okay, we'll keep our guns inside our houses and we'll still observe the police, etc. But by this time, we've already captured the imagination of the people. Mm-hmm. And by here is where it was a tactic to patrol the police to capture the imagination of the people, get more people coming so I could organize a political electoral machine. Party members did not have to carry guns. What I'm trying to say is party members who join, you do not have to carry guns. We have other programs we're going to organize around, et cetera, and we're going to get people registered to vote so we can take over some political seats so we can change the racist laws.
And, Stephen, you wrote in the book, compare this, meaning that same moment we played the clip from and that whole issue of that law, to the reaction when, after a white man killed 20 children at Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012, conservatives in Congress defeated President Obama's attempt to limit rapid-firing assault weapons while right-wing commentators vilified him and the National Rifle Association advocated arming teachers. What point are you making with that comparison?
Well, the point I'm making is that when white people carry guns openly, that's patriotism. When black people carry guns openly, that's seen as a threat, and they pass a law against it. And in the 1966 or whatever, when the Mulford Act was passed, the NRA said nothing. Everyone was just totally silent on it. The Panthers did not carry assault weapons, by the way. They carried
shotguns and rifles. That's all we carried.
Pistols. They carried shotguns, pistols, and rifles, which are self-defense weapons, not offensive weapons. And so I just wanted to make the point that I think, you know, there's a little bit of hypocrisy involved and possibly racism involved in the part of some of the right-wing commentators who send out these literature, Obama's going to take away your gun. When in fact, what Obama's proposed is number one, just limiting rapid firing assault weapons. Number two, having checks for mental health issues. And number three, keeping people who we won't let fly in airplanes have rapid fire assault weapons, which is a very minor compared to what they passed against the Panthers, which was effectively a total gun control.
There's an anecdote in the book about the very first patrol interaction with the police. A group of Panthers led by the Panthers co-founder, Huey Newton, responded to a traffic stop and simply watched the officer arrest the driver. When confronted by the officer, Newton asserted his Second Amendment right to bear arms and his right to observe police officers from a reasonable distance. That approach seems gone today. We associate the Second Amendment people, those who declare their Second Amendment rights very loudly and publicly, with that NRA mindset that Stephen was just talking about. While Black Lives Matter and other social justice and racial justice groups of today do not advocate carrying arms as they fight or monitor police brutality.
I don't advocate it either. Look, in the last 30 years that I have been sending out bio information to colleges and universities, I've spoken to over 550 colleges in my lifetime, but my point is this here. I explain in that bio, today you do not need guns. In fact, we got the technology. The technology is good enough because we can now record and capture and have a mass people's cop watch program. And then the guns, in effect, after the Mulford Act, we did not walk down the street with guns and carry open guns. But we found certain laws, for instance, when the Ku Klux Klan flushed 3,000 letters and stuff threatening to kill and murder us, et cetera, and so on, so on, so on, so on. I had all my party members all across the country copy every one of these and send the original letters in, and we sent the original to our lawyers, and we had that, and then found other laws connected with kidnapping laws. If you believe your loved one's lives may be in danger, a person can actually carry a concealed weapon without a permit under California law. I don't know about other states. I'm just saying, and we carried it. And I packed a .357 Magnum Python when I organized around the community, either in the glove compartment or sometime I would strap it on. My brother John Seale was arrested 3 times carrying his 9mm in those organizing days. And Charles R. Gary would call the DA over there and says, you know, seal it under this law, man. And they let him give my brother his gun back.
Yeah, man, but you said you don't need to anymore because of technology.
At a certain period in history. And right now you don't need to run around with guns. And watch out about this open carry stuff. This open carry stuff is to get you out there and this stand your ground crap. These are laws that they're allowing right wingers and so-called patriotic to have the right to shoot and kill you. You know what I mean? So don't need the laws. Use the peaceful demonstration methodology. Understand the value of the peaceful protests.
And to that point, Stephen, in traditional terms, as a photographer, you were documenting the movie, the movement that Bobby was in the center of and at the forefront of. Today, taking video of police interactions is a central feature of the movement. So has the cell phone replaced the gun as a tool of the modern civil rights movement? Stephen, for you as a photographer?
I think the camera's always been a powerful tool. When I started taking pictures, actually, one of the reasons I started taking pictures for the Berkeley Barb, in addition to the Panthers, was to document police brutality. I was a student at the University of California at Berkeley, and the police would regularly be on campus and beat up students.
And now everybody's a photographer.
And now, well, everyone thinks they're a photographer.
But
everybody,
multi-millions.
Everyone has a camera, and it's very, you know, they're documenting all those things, and that's very important. I mean, recently in Chicago, I remember that a black man was shot and killed, and the original story was that he attacked the police, and then when the video came out, it turned out that he was walking away from them and was shot in the back. The video showing that young 12-year-old boy in Cleveland, which, by the way, Ohio is an open carry state. So even if that kid had been carrying a real gun, why did the police shoot him? It's an open carry state. You're supposed to be able to openly carry a gun in Ohio. But again, that's one of the central issues that the Panthers have talked about.
Before you go, and I want to tell people how they can see you in person at an event that's coming up. As you know, one of the Chicago 8 defendants, along with you, Bobby, after the Chicago Democratic Convention in 1968 and the protests, was Tom Hayden, who just passed away the other day. He appears in the book in a few places, including a good quote about the Panthers. Were you close at all at the time, or anything you want to say about his legacy from those days?
Yeah, because me and Tom Hayden, you know, were on trial together in the Great Chicago 7 conspiracy trial. I was the 8th defendant. Tom Hayden, I really first met him way before that, Ann Arbor, Michigan, around the time of the Peace and Freedom Party convention, what have you, et cetera. And he's a writer, and we happened to be assigned to the same hotel room, which we had to straighten out later. But I'm just saying, he was always the intellectual to me. And he was reserved a lot, you know what I mean? But even he and I, ultimately, we agreed on the concepts of broad reform changes, many reform changes, to evolve greater human equality and economic. This is the kind of stuff that Tom was. You know, Tom was that kind of guy, and that's where he was. Me, I'm a hardline vocal person. You know what I mean? Besides organizer. I'm a detail organizer, but I'm vocal in another context, you know.
Yeah, Tom was also a friend of mine, was just a great person, and Tom also ran for elective office and was elected to the state assembly in California. Mm-hmm. Again, that's a misconception about the Panthers and about the left movement, SDS, and that, you know, they were really about electoral change, and really, in a sense, that's peaceful democratic change. That's what the Constitution protects, and that's what it's about.
Bobby Seale and Steve Shames have a new book, Power to the People, The World of the Black Panthers. You can see one of Stephen's photographs on our website. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show for one little taste. And if you want to see them in person, they will be in conversation with filmmaker Byron Hurt at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. That's at 515 Malcolm X. Tonight in Harlem at 6:30, 515 Malcolm X Boulevard. If you haven't been to the Schomburg Center before, it's free, but registration is required. You can find the link on our webpage as well, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show if you want to go to that 6:30 tonight event. And an exhibition of the visual work is currently on view at the Stephen Kasher Gallery in Chelsea. That's at 515 West 26th Street. Thanks so much for coming in today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and in this era of police shootings of unarmed black men caught on tape, here's a story of a police officer encountering a black woman who he believed was carrying a rifle and the ensuing interaction. Spoiler alert, it ended peacefully despite some factors that too often lead to tragedy. The woman happened to be Joanne Allen, a longtime member of the WNYC family who hosted Morning Edition and All Things Considered here for 18 years, as many of you will remember. She's now the host of All Things Considered at Colorado Public Radio. Joanne Allen joins me now. Hey, Joanne, it's been too long, and who thought we'd talk again under circumstances like these?
I know, Brian. This is really, really wild. I just wanted to say hello to everybody who's listening in the metropolitan area, and also to all of my friends at WNYC. It's good to be on your show.
It's great to hear your voice, Joanne, really. So tell us about this interaction you had with Arapahoe County Sheriff Deputy Tom Finley.
Well, I was on my way to work, and I was not far from Colorado Public Radio when I heard someone from behind me say, "Sir, drop the rifle. Sir, drop the rifle." And I knew that I was carrying something that could resemble a rifle because I'd had that conversation with someone else before. And I slowly turned through the golf clubs away from my body and held my arms out and my hands open, so that he could clearly see that I wasn't carrying anything else. And I said very nervously, "They're golf clubs, they're golf clubs." And so he had his hand on his gun, and he slowly approached me. He was about maybe 15 feet from me to start. He slowly approached me, looked over, saw they were golf clubs, and he said, "I apologize for challenging you. I can see those are golf clubs," which blew me away. You know, I was just so confused about everything at that moment. But the fact that he apologized so quickly and took his hand off his gun and approached me slowly still was pretty amazing. I was quaking in my boots. I was very nervous, as I think anyone would be, because of the shock of everything that happened. And the thing that really, you know, he was so stealth in approaching me because I heard nothing until he, you know, shouted out the command. And I think it was because my nervousness came from, I didn't know who was approaching me. It could have been another citizen. He didn't say, "I'm a police officer" or anything. He just said, "Drop the rifle." So I complied, and from then on out, things were a little bit smoother. But I applaud the deputy for his calmness under what could have been a difficult situation for him as well.
So I'm going to play a clip for our New York listeners from the Colorado radio interview you did with him, Sheriff Tom Finley, about the incident. This is from the Colorado Matters podcast from Colorado Public Radio. And in this clip, Sheriff Finley talks to host Ryan Warner about the training he received that prepared him for the situation that the two of you were involved in.
That's one of the things we train too, is to be calm in crisis situations, because if you're out of control yourself, you're going to do more harm than good. We do a lot of, you know, shoot, don't shoot type training at the range where, you know, they train the calm into you, basically.
Have you been in a situation like this before?
I don't think specifically like this one, but I have dealt with armed subjects before. I mean, you definitely fall back on the training when you get into stressful situations.
Joanne, how did he come to approach you in the first place? There you just were shopping, it sounds like, and suddenly there's a sheriff's deputy behind you thinking you had a rifle. How did he even come in to be in that situation with you?
Well, Brian, I take the light rail to work, and I thank my years in New York for still being a public transportation person. And so there's about a 7-minute walk from the light rail to Colorado Public Radio, and I was crossing the parking lot at a 7-Eleven. From what I understood, I had no idea why he stopped me, but from what I understood is that the Arapahoe County Sheriff's Department closed down all of their radio frequencies for just this emergency call that had come in of someone who said they saw a black male carrying a rifle. And that's how the deputy was just happened to have been at the 7-Eleven in an unmarked car. And he saw that there was this black person, at least not a male, but a black person carrying something that could look like a rifle. And so he just thought to himself, well, I think there's that person. So he just came up behind me very slowly and very quietly, and that's when he shouted the command to drop the rifle.
And you also obtained, and we're going to play now, part of the 911 call that was made to by a motorist who reported to police that there was a black man holding a rifle, he assumed.
He's a black man, black in dress, carrying a rifle.
Okay.
I don't know if it's nothing or if he's going somewhere to do something. You know what I mean? You just don't see guys carrying rifles around anymore like that, you know?
You just don't see guys carrying rifles around anymore like that, you know? What was your reaction when you heard the 911 call that led to the incident that obviously you didn't know of before the incident?
It was scary because, whenever you hear anything that's the official policedom stuff, it just kind of freaks you out a little bit. I think after the officer stopped me, and I have to say three times apologized for challenging me, I thought, who would call this in? Who? And he said, I have no idea. I don't know. But when the call goes out, I just have to respond. And so then he apologized again, and he gave me his card. Now, I found out that this guy's really well-trained. So I want to talk to him about how he handled the situation and talk with him about whether or not he was afraid or nervous, because after all, he was approaching someone who looked like they had a rifle.
Mm-hmm.
And so I must admit, when I saw his face, because he looks like he's 12 practically, but he really is in his late 30s. He's been 16 years on the force. But I found out that they didn't train him to apologize. They did train him to give his card after every incident. But the fact that he apologized so profusely, and I could feel his humanity, if you know what I mean,
mm-hmm.
that made me think, oh, I would really just love to talk to him. And so that's when we got together about a week or so ago and sat down and talked about our experience and what we were feeling. And luckily for both of us, and I really mean that, not just me, but for both of us, it turned out okay.
So here's Deputy Finley discussing the way he processed the incident hours after it happened.
I kind of talked more about, you know, the what ifs. You know, what if you hadn't complied and, you know, dropped the golf clubs, what I thought was a rifle? What if it had gone really poorly and I had shot you and then found out they were golf clubs? I mean, that was something I talked about with one of my really good friends and how terrible that would have been.
Colorado is an open carry state, isn't it?
It is.
So do you think if you were white and carrying a golf bag, you would have sparked the same suspicion from the motorist?
You know, I don't know. I would guess so, because you don't see people openly carrying guns, even handguns or sidearms. And a rifle, I think, in this neck of the woods is really something that makes people a bit nervous, given that we are about, I'd say, 10 to 20 miles away from where the Aurora Theater shooting happened.
Mm-hmm.
We are about 10 miles or so from Littleton, where the Columbine High School shooting happened. There was a shooting about 3 years ago of a young woman at Arapahoe High School, which is also not far from here. But I would say that in, think about a year ago in Colorado Springs, there was a man walking around on the street with a gun, and nobody called it in. And he, in fact, went and killed several people sitting on a porch that he didn't know. So I think there's a hypersensitivity possibly about seeing someone with what looks like a rifle. If I had been at the 7-Eleven and saw someone with what I thought looked like a rifle, I would have called it in.
Yeah.
I definitely would have.
Because
you have to remember...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, you have to remember, these are wide open spaces out here. So you can easily spot people and see them. It's not like New York, not the density of New York. If I were walking down Third Avenue with a rifle, number one, people would see I was a woman. But also, they would immediately see that it's either a rifle or golf clubs. But from a distance, I know that they looked like a rifle.
And I don't play golf, so maybe I just have some outdated image of what a bag of golf clubs looked like, but I'm thinking of a sort of straight cylindrical thing. I saw the photo on a website of, you know, about the story of your bag of golf clubs, and it kind of looks shaped like a rifle.
Yeah, definitely. And I was only carrying four clubs at the time, the four clubs that I needed the most practice on from my last round of golf. And so it wasn't a golf bag, not like you see when you watch a tournament, but a much smaller travel bag that's designed to carry only a few clubs. And it's got a kind of a bulbous end, and the other end, the clubs stick out. And then there's a strap to it. And the way I was carrying it in my left hand, it could easily look like I was carrying a rifle. So I wasn't so upset that I was stopped. I was definitely experiencing PTSD afterwards, because while it was happening, the adrenaline was flowing and I was nervous. But then as the day wore on, that's when I started to think, oh, my goodness, this Centennial, which is the suburb we're located in, Centennial could have been the next Ferguson.
Yeah.
And it just freaked me out when I started to think about what had happened, much more so than in the moment. I was nervous, but I wasn't as freaked out as the day wore on.
Joanne Allen, who many of you remember as longtime host of All Things Considered and Morning Edition here on WNYC, now at Colorado Public Radio and in the news because of this incident that thankfully ended well. I'm so glad you're okay, and I'm really glad you came and shared this with us today, Joanne.
I am so happy to have appeared on the Brian Lehrer Show. You just don't know. I'm going to brag for a few days.
Take it easy, Joanne. We'll talk off the air.
Okay. Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC, and Bruce Springsteen published a memoir last month, as many of you know. It's called Born to Run, and it's incisive, thoughtful, funny, and brimming with stories that give a satisfying peek into how the boss has crafted his narratives of broken heroes chasing that runaway American dream. And while we've been knee-deep in election politics, the book got us thinking about how the themes in Springsteen's songs keep on cropping up in American politics and society. Many of you had fun with our Bruce the Debate hashtag this week, so we thought we'd take a little time now to talk about the actual book and the artist and dig into a few songs that still resonate so much, whether they were written 4 or 40 years ago. So here with me now to follow a couple of those threads is David Camp, a Vanity Fair contributing editor who recently profiled Springsteen for the magazine. Hi, David. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be with you.
And let's listen to some music and talk about some of these ideas after hearing more specific examples. Here's about 45 seconds of the song The Promised Land, which came out on the record Darkness on the Edge of Town back in 1978.
I've done my best to live the right way.
Believe in a promised land. What's going on with this man in the promised land? The promised land referenced in the song gives it a hopeful sheen. What do you think Springsteen is referring to there? And should this guy be hopeful?
I think it's despair mixed with hope, because he's talking about, you know, in the earlier part of the song, he's working at his daddy's garage. But then he says he wants, in the part we just heard, he wants to explode and tear this town apart, take a knife and cut this pain from my heart. It's a really prevalent theme, especially of kind of the 70s and early 80s Springsteen, is restlessness. There's got to be something somewhere better for me. But it's not despairing. There's always a tincture of hope, though Springsteen would never use a word like tincture. But I mean, there's always a sense of a better life somewhere. I just got to get out of here.
Mm-hmm. So here's another one from that era, and tell me if you think this is thematically similar or different. This is the title track from The River.
I got a job working construction for the Johnstown Company. But lately there ain't been much work on account of the economy. Now all them things that seem so important, well, mister, they vanished right into the air. Now I just act like I don't remember. Mary acts like she don't care.
So that was 1980 Springsteen. The Johnstown Company that he mentions refers, I think, to a real-life company in a town in western Pennsylvania steel country, or one that's emblematic of real ones there. And this, you know, Donald Trump is actually holding a rally in Johnstown, Pennsylvania today.
This very afternoon at the War Memorial Arena. So that speaks a lot to how things have perhaps evolved from 1980 when the song came out to now, that you might have had a character like the protagonist in The River. He might have been one of those guys with a union job who faithfully voted up and down the Democratic Party ticket, because that's what union guys did in those days. And, you know, since Bruce Springsteen characters are fictional characters, we're allowed to extrapolate about what becomes of them. It's conceivable, Brian, that this guy might have gone from union straight Democratic ticket guy to Reagan Democrat to Republican to Tea Party to Trump. It's, you know, possible.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We're in New York and New Jersey Public Radio as we talk about some of the themes in Bruce Springsteen's new memoir, Born to Run, and listen to a little relevant music with David Camp, Vanity Fair contributing editor, who recently profiled Springsteen for the magazine. That song, by the way, I understand was written for his sister and brother-in-law,
whose lives started out like the narrator in the song. What was their story?
Right. So there's a conflation of that Johnstown, Pennsylvania steel mill worker or construction worker. The actual circumstances of Bruce Springsteen's sister Virginia's life, when she was a senior in high school, age 17, she got married to, or she got pregnant by, in her senior year of high school, a fellow named Mickey Shave. And suddenly, as they say in the song, "The River," that was all she wrote. They had a shotgun marriage. Mickey took on jobs in construction. She took a job in South Jersey working for Kmart. And they were a working-class, struggling couple. And this is before Bruce Springsteen has struck it rich, so he couldn't feather bed their existence with his residual wealth.
And we learn in the book, if we didn't know it already, that his dad was a gruff, detached guy who struggled with mental illness. Is it the specter of his father who hangs over a lot of his songs and his characters?
Absolutely, because the father embodied this restlessness that we've talked about. His father was a man who was a brooder, who drank six packs of beer in the dark in his kitchen, and his relationship with Bruce was very volatile. And ultimately, it kind of did explode into this flight west to California. When Ginny, the younger sister, was pregnant, and when Bruce was only 19, Dad just said, "Forget this. We're moving to California and leaving you kids behind."
And those are some of the roots that give Springsteen his working class bona fides to fuel his songwriting.
Right. And I mean, forget about that experience. Just the first 10 years of his life, even though they took place in the 1950s, were almost more Dust Bowl John Steinbeck than Ozzy and Harriet. You know, he was real privation, real that living in a ramshackle house with three generations, with his grandparents there. He had a tough, true to his persona, working class, bordering on poor upbringing.
One kind of funny side note, I learned from the book that Springsteen has never really held any kind of job other than playing music. Is that kind of ironic, considering he writes so much and so well about the working person?
You might say it, but if you think of how he approached rock music, he actually says in the book something along the lines of, "I put on a factory worker's clothes. I put on my father's clothes to go to work." The only way he saw out of this, you know, post-industrial despair of Freehold, New Jersey, was music. And he went about it in a very workmanlike way.
We're going to move from the late 70s, early 80s to a more contemporary song. Here's a bit of the song, "Death to My Hometown," from Springsteen's 2012 album, Wrecking Ball.
"Send a robber bound straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around ate the flesh of everything they found. His crimes have gone unpunished now. Who walk the streets as free men now? Now they're going
could imagine a crowd singing there with their fist in the air like an anthem, except it's such a dreary message. Death to our hometown, boys. It should have been a football rah-rah with that kind of musical setting, I thought. But then when you listen to the rest of the lyrics in that verse, the greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Is this sort of Springsteen's Occupy song?
Yeah, this is his Occupy Wall Street anthem. Bear in mind, it came out in 2012. I think it was written a couple of years earlier when we're still very much in the post-2008 recession. And we know Bruce Springsteen's politics to tack left. So we know that this would almost be a more of a Bernie song than a Trump song. But that said, if you look at the lyrics, they're about holding bankers and hedge fund guys accountable for looting the factories and destroying the way of life of the working and middle class people in this putatively New Jersey town, the hometown. And so he's not chanting death to my hometown. He's saying these guys caused the death, and now it's time for vengeance. And Brian, what's interesting about this song in 2012 is that you no longer have that hope that even his despairing 70s and early 80s protagonists have.
Wow. If your profile of in your profile of Springsteen for this month's Vanity Fair, you talked about the actual song Born to Run, which is arguably his most famous song, and he named the book after it. It's the climax of every single concert he plays, or so I'm told. The two that I've seen, it was, and he told you that he never really gets sick of it. Now, he was on Fresh Air earlier this month, and in this 15-second clip, he explains to Terry Gross how some of his older songs hold up.
So it was going back to my earliest music and re-singing my earliest songs that I wrote when I was 22. And it was funny that they just fit perfectly well. You know, there was they sort of gather the years up as time passes.
I love that phrase he uses, the songs gather the years up. What do you think he means by that exactly?
Well, he means that the themes resonate no matter what the era. And he said a good song. And one interesting thing about Bruce Springsteen is he's unprepossessing, but he's not immodest. Very conscious of, I have made an important contribution to American culture. And that was by design, too. That's, again, to go back to your question about, did he ever do an honest day's work? His workmanlike approach was to build up a great canon of songs. And Born to Run was consciously conceived when he was still a young fellow to be an important, durable song.
Here's one more clip of Springsteen from that Fresh Air interview, talking about why he still lives pretty close to where he grew up in central New Jersey.
I just felt very comfortable here, and I was uncomfortable with city life. I was more or less a kid that came out of a small town, and I was a beach bum and loved the ocean and loved the sun, and I liked the people that were here. I liked who I was when I was here. I wanted to continue writing about the things that I felt were important, and those things were pretty much here. I felt like a lot of my heroes from the past lost themselves in different ways once they had a certain amount of success. And I was nervous about that, and I wanted to remain grounded. And living in this part of New Jersey was something that was, it was essential to who I was and continues to this day to be that way.
Continues to this day to be that way. Do you think that's part of what keeps him so relevant musically and culturally?
Absolutely. He never became part of an L.A. or New York or a coastal elite scene, even though he, you know, owns a house in L.A. He never became part of a scene. He stayed in New Jersey. Brian, I actually wanted to share with you a quote that didn't make my Vanity Fair piece where we discussed this and how he said he never was fully part of the counterculture. He said, my band is pre and post hippie in a funny sort of way. There's a counterculture element that just came from growing up at that time. But I think there was also a suspiciousness of it because we came out of a small town where a lot of people went a different way. Like I was saying in the book, my brother-in-law, and this brings us, Brian, back to the river, my brother-in-law is a man of the 50s, and he'd lived his life like that. I have a foot in there myself. That's Bruce talking. So he's saying, like, I never turned on and tuned in, all that stuff. I retain a suspicion of the coastal elites myself.
This memoir is more than 500 pages long. Does it hold up as a book?
It's wonderful. And, you know, I was not mandated to come to that conclusion because I was profiling him. It's very easy to read. It's very episodic, short chapters. I asked him if he'd read Bob Dylan's Chronicles, which is much more elliptical and episodic. And he said, yeah, and I really love that book, but there was no way I could do a book like that. I just, same thing, put on my factory man's clothes, put my head down, and write it chronologically.
And Springsteen came out, last thing, just this week with a stinging rebuke of Donald Trump, even though in a way they seem to speak to the same core constituency. How do you see the overlap between Springsteen and Trump, touching some of the same hearts and minds as personal to the listener, despite coming to very different worldviews?
Well, they both have a talent for rousing huge, mostly white crowds. But the crucial difference is, and Bruce Springsteen's been giving interviews in Britain this past week where he's promoting the book. He has sympathy for the people in those crowds. He's more never Trump than with her, perhaps. And he's saying these people are being conned. And he's working against that. He's saying these people have a reason to feel disenfranchised by globalization and the obsolescence of factory jobs, but that fellow is a con man. He's not the one who's going to lead them to the promised land.
And we leave it there with Vanity Fair contributing editor David Camp. Thanks so much for coming on the show and talking about Bruce Springsteen's memoir, Born to Run.
Thank you, and thanks for Bruce the debate. Loved it.
Make an honest stand, but they wind up wounded, not even dead.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.